Hey, Keely.
Hey, Chris.
Welcome to Heard It on the Sidelines.
Heard It
on the Sideline with Shotgun Spratling.
That is correct. We are back. We've got another episode of the Heard It on the Sidelines podcast for you guys, and this is going to be a really cool one today. A Hall of Fame edition, if you will. I'm your host, Shotgun Spratling. First off, saying thank you to Keely and Chris for the intro, and thank you to everyone for joining us. For anyone listening in for the first time, the Heard It on the Sidelines podcast is a part of the Peristyle podcast family. It's the podcast where we discuss what's going on at USC, but also try to pull back the curtain to give you an insider's perspective from the people around the USC athletic programs. April 8th is a special date to me for reasons I'll keep to myself, but on this special date, we're going to do something a little different because, well, it's my podcast and I do what I want. Today's the 47th anniversary of Henry Louis Aaron Hammerin, Hank Aaron, breaking one of the all-time career records, hitting home run number 715 to pass Babe Ruth on the career home run list.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting, the outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
That was the call from Vin Scully. Growing up a Braves fan, that record has always meant a lot to me. I've always taken pride in Hank Aaron's accomplishment that day and seeing his name, number, and story all over first Atlanta Fulton County Stadium and later Turner Field. I remember seeing the date, April 8, 1974, and the number 715 at my first ball game as a little boy. It was on a logo plastered on the outfield wall in Fulton County Stadium at the spot where the ball cleared the fence. That wall logo still stands in a parking lot where the stadium used to be, even though the Braves have now twice moved stadiums since.
What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world.
Again, from Vin Scully. Aaron was an icon and a hero in Atlanta from my childhood days, but it wasn't until later in life, fascinated by baseball history and the Negro Leagues, that I began to understand what Hank Aaron had to endure on his path to 715 and the full impact he had on the city of Atlanta, the state of Georgia, and the nation as a whole.
A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol. And it is a great moment for all of us, and particularly for Henry Aaron, who was met at home plate not only by every member of the Braves, but by his father and mother.
We'll get into this with one of our guests, but Henry Aaron was initially opposed to the Braves moving from Milwaukee to Atlanta. The Alabama native said, "I've lived in the South, and I don't want to live there again." And without Aaron, there may not have been a team to move. Yet he would eventually become Atlanta's greatest icon, helping to integrate the South as the Braves became the first pro sports team in the Deep South. Following Henry Aaron's death earlier this year, just shy of his 87th birthday, I've been wanting to put together a special USC Hank Aaron connected show, and there feels like no better date than April 8th to talk about the Hall of Fame outfielder who is the all-time RBI and total bases leader, who was named to 21 consecutive All-Star games, who was top 20 in MVP balloting 19 years in a row, a symbol of consistency. He had 8 seasons with 40 home runs, another 7 with 30 or more. He was an MVP, a Gold Glove winner. Over his career in different seasons, he led the league in hits, runs, doubles, RBIs, batting average, slugging, total bases, and obviously he led the league in home runs in multiple seasons. So I've got two special USC guests that knew Henry Aaron at different stages in his career, in his life. Former USC pitcher and later USC pitching coach Tom House has a special place in the history of home run number 715. He was in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium that night, that spring night, April 8th, 1974, when the Braves played the Dodgers. House was relief pitcher with the Braves, and he's actually the person who caught the home run that Hank Aaron hit off Al Downing. House joins us to talk about that moment, how he was in prime position to catch the home run in the Braves bullpen, and what it was like playing alongside Henry Aaron. The boss man, Ryan Abraham, joins me as we couldn't have the illustrious Tom House, a pitching and throwing motion guru, on the show and not pick his brain about a number of other topics, including USC baseball, throwing bullpens beside Tom Seaver, how he helped another former Trojan Hall of Famer get on track in the big leagues with the help of yet another all-time MLB pitching great, House also talks about the work his organization 3DQB has done this offseason with USC quarterback Keaton Slovis. Look, you knew there was going to be a tie to USC football. And the potential of Slovis getting over his sophomore funk. We talked to Tom about what it's like working with pros of the ilk of Tom Brady and Drew Brees, down to preteens. He works with everyone. And about a new initiative he's helping with, an app called Mustard, that could potentially help democratize personalized pitching QB training. Our second special guest is a part of the USC football program. I told you there'd be a tie in there. But also has a Hank Aaron connection. We'll talk with USC Assistant Athletic Director and Director of Player Development, Gavin Morris. You know Gavin as the guy that helps the Trojans land all the big fish recruits behind the scenes. He's everyone's favorite and someone every recruit considers their guy. Yeah, that's my guy, Gav. While we'd love to get Gavin on to talk about some of the nuances of recruiting and his path to where he is now, we've only got so much time for this episode, so we're going to try to stick on topic. We'll be talking to Gav about his connection with Henry Aaron, having worked with the Atlanta Braves while in school at Morehouse College in Atlanta, and how a disastrous initial encounter with Aaron turned into what Gavin calls the most inspirational 30 minutes of his life. You definitely got to listen to this story. Gavin also gives some insights into what Aaron and his record meant to the city of Atlanta and to the African-American community as a whole. So let's jump into it with our first special guest on today with a Hank Aaron and USC connection, Tom House, who played at USC before moving on to a professional career with the Atlanta Braves, also the Boston Red Sox and Seattle Mariners, later moved into coaching, working as a pitching coach with the Rangers, Astros, Padres, and even in the Japanese Nippon League before returning to USC as a pitching coach from 2008 to 2011. He's been working with quarterbacks and pitchers and catchers throughout his career. He's working with a couple different organizations now, but we wanted to first talk about, you know, with the anniversary of Hank Aaron. Tom, you know, thanks for joining us. And first, just what was it like playing with Hank Aaron? How was he as a teammate?
Oh, well, that's two or three good answers in a row right there. Playing with Henry was special. You know, realized that I was a low-end guy, like a 10th man on a 10-man pitching staff. But being in the clubhouse with Henry on a regular basis for 7 or 8 years, the only way I can describe it is he was like a normal guy, quietly competent, but a superstar with everything he did. He'd play hearts, he'd play cards with guys like myself, bullpen guys. He was a guy you could have a beer with after the game. You never really knew he was around until the game itself got tight. And there was Hank Aaron hitting a home run, throwing somebody out or stealing a base. So if I had to describe hanging out with him, he was the most quietly competent superstar that I've seen in my tenure as a professional player or a coach. And that's 50 years. So he was pretty special.
How do you kind of use what you learn from watching and being around him, even still today, maybe?
Well, I got to know him a little bit better than most because he had trouble with left-handed pitchers that threw slow. Curveballs, changeup, screwballs. But I got a chance to throw a lot of batting practice to him on Diamond 6 in West Palm Beach, a couple buckets 2 times a week, and then tune-up during the season. So I also tried to sit next to him in the dugout and listen to how he talked about what he was going to do against various pitchers. So it was an education hanging around with him. It was fun throwing batting practice to him. And then actually being involved in catching number 715. The good news is that's the highlight of my major league career. That's also the bad news. That's the highlight of my major league career.
It's the anniversary of that catch. Is that something that was common? Like in the bullpen, would you be catching home runs? Or was that one just one you were looking for because of it, because it was a special one?
Well, it was a special one. We actually, leading into it, you know, he'd been chasing the record all during the 1973 season and being 2 home runs away from breaking it going into the 74 season. We had to determine, come up with a plan not to have it, you know, if he did hit it into the bullpen, what we did as a group was we divided territory that was behind the left field fence into however many bullpen guys were out there. So my 10 yards was basically in left center. And everybody agreed to respect if the ball was hit in your territory. It wasn't going to be a pig pile or diving or, you know, jumping for the ball. So as it turned out, if I would have stood still, it would have bounced right off my forehead. So it was no great catch or anything. Just, you know, luck of the draw, blind squirrel finding an acorn, was hit to me.
I don't know. Hank was good enough. Maybe he aimed it for you on that one. You know, his eyes probably lit up with that, with the fat pitch coming in. What kind of happened after, you know, the catch? You know, you were active participant in this historic play. You catch the ball. What then happens after that moment?
Well, I'd like to say I remember everything that happened. I do remember catching the ball. I do remember seeing Bill Buckner, who was left fielder with the Dodgers at that time, climbing to the top of the fence. And I do remember a fishnet coming from the stands above me, swishing down right behind me. I guess one of the Georgia Tech guys had put an extension on a fishnet and were trying to get it. And then the next real memory I had was arriving at home plate and kind of breaking through the crowd and reaching through. He was hugging his mom. The two of them were there with tears in their eyes. And I can remember sticking the ball in front of his face and saying, here it is, Hammer. And he said, thanks, kid. And I kind of got pushed out of the way. So that's what I remember about it. You know, it was exciting, but in retrospect, it happened. There was so much excitement in the stands. Probably not ingrained fully in my conscious mind, only my subconscious.
During that whole ordeal, you know, his mom comes out and hugs him, and she later says that she was hugging him to protect him, and, you know, and that she was going to go with him if there was a sniper or something. There were so many death threats and stuff that he received, and some of that stuff came out, you know, afterwards. Did everyone in the locker room really understand what he was going through at that time with the death threats he was receiving, the pressure that was placed on him, especially with the offseason, you know, being one home run shy of tying it going through that offseason? Did you guys kind of understand what was going on at the time in history?
Yeah, we knew something was going on. Because he had a full-time bodyguard, Calvin. And toward the end of the 73 season, Henry would not ride the bus with us. He'd take a different way to get from airport to hotel. He had, you know, a room under a different name. And we kind of heard stuff. I went through the minor leagues with Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr, and Henry was kind of full-time buddies with them. They all piled around together. So I was aware of some of the weird stuff that was going on, but probably not to the level that Henry was experiencing on a day-to-day basis.
Where does Hank Aaron stand in your ranking of all-time greats?
In my generation, he was right up there. I think he had the same or better statistics as Roberto Clemente. And I'm guessing I'm going to blank the outfielder with the San Francisco, Willie Mays. He fit right in the slot probably between those two guys for me. And the probably the reason he didn't get as much PR was that he played in Milwaukee and Atlanta, and he wasn't flashy. You know, he was just, like I say, you never really knew how fast he was until you saw him running next to somebody that was fast. And he never really hit towering home runs. He just basically, if the fence was 318, he hit it 324. You know, they shifted on him. He hit the ball through the shift, and if he had to, he shoot it to right field. If a base needed to be stolen to get into scoring position in a nothing-nothing or a one-run game, he would figure out a way to do it. But he was never real flashy. He would communicate great in the clubhouse, but he was kind of, his platform skills were more towards shy than effervescent, if that makes any sense.
Tom, you started your career, your professional career with Atlanta. I know when you came out of USC, part of your signing bonus was they were going to pay for your education. Were you going to school, or did you wait till afterwards? When did you end up, you know, going through and getting your master's and your PhD And I know, and I believe that was part of your signing bonus that you signed with Atlanta.
Yeah, boy, you guys have done your homework. I'm impressed. The head coach at that time was Rod Dedeaux. Not only was he, the coach of the century in collegiate baseball, but he was a firm believer in education. One of the reasons I ended up going to USC is that he told my parents point blank in the recruiting that he, in our living room, he said, "I can't guarantee you that he'll make a living playing baseball, but I can guarantee you he'll get a degree from USC. And then I'll always, if he stays in Southern California, he'll always have a job." So one of the things that he promised my mom was he would make sure that I would get a degree. And then when I did sign, he said, "Tom, you're not going to get a lot of money, not going to get a big bonus. But if you ask the Braves for your education, it comes from a different part of the budget, and they'll give you your education for whatever you ask for." So I did. And I, like, as Rod promised, I ended up getting actually 2 degrees from SC and then another master's and my PhD beyond that. And I believe that I'm the only athlete that played for Rod that ended up getting different degrees and a PhD on top of it, at least that I'm aware of. So I was very thankful. He saw a way to help everybody that he coached be better for the experience.
Was there some kind of time limit on that? Because it probably took you a while to get your PhD, right? Was Atlanta was still paying for it like decades later? Was that the case?
Yeah. Yep. It carried all the way. I think I got my PhD finally in 1984. So do the math. I was however many years that was. I just did it a semester at a time. And in those days, you had to do it by correspondence. Tutorials. You couldn't do it online like they do today. So it turned out it was kind of a long haul going through it. But in retrospect, it was worth every bit of it.
The Braves didn't know they were getting a Bobby Bonilla's type of contract there when they signed into that education bonus.
Obviously, they changed the rules to where you have to get your education completed within 8 years of your retirement. So, I didn't have a big effect on baseball, but that's one thing that they probably had to change the rules for.
Well, you have had a big effect as far as working with pitching mechanics and being kind of cutting edge and kind of being the father of what was kind of seen a little bit as weird at the time and now has become more and more commonplace. You coached with the Texas Rangers and you coached another great during your time there with Nolan Ryan. When he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1999, he credited you for basically helping extend his career. First, just what did it mean to you to be there and have him mention you in his induction speech?
Well, obviously, hanging out with Nolan, being his coach, and I'd like to say a friend of his, it was pretty special to be recognized in his Hall of Fame speech. But what was really cool is it sounds like it was all well planned out, that we knew exactly what we were doing, and that motion analysis and the technology that we were dealing with was the reason for all of it happening. It wasn't that way at all. It was very organic. I actually had a motion analysis system for 2 years, and we had captured hundreds of athletes, and I didn't even know what I was looking at. It was learning on the fly, and I honestly feel I learned more from the superstars, the Nolan Ryans and the Randy Johnsons and the Tom Bradys and the Drew Breeses. I think I learned more from them than they learned from me. So, like I said, it probably wasn't well scripted, but it turned out to be a very positive thing as far as identifying how human beings throw and swing.
That was kind of cutting edge at the time. And like you said, it was kind of an organic trying to figure out how it would work. But what has motivated you to continually seek new information? I mean, even today, you're still working on new things. Why do you are you constantly evolving yourself?
Again, I like to tell people I've I've never really had a real job in my life. I've always been involved with sports. I've worked really hard, but it's always been a passion and a quest for trying to get better myself, as well as help the athletes that we're dealing with. And I don't know if you're aware that my time frame when I was up at USC, not only was I the pitching coach for 4 years, we had the Rod Dedeaux Research and Baseball Institute, and that's where a lot of the science that's out there right now with weighted balls and velocity improvement, heavy and light bats, functional strength training, nutrition, sleep. We did a whole bunch of research in the 10 years that I was there from 2008 to 2018. It was a pretty exciting time, not just because of the sports, but because of the research that was going on behind the scenes at the Rod Dedeaux Research and Baseball Institute.
You mentioned Randy Johnson there. I believe Nolan Ryan kind of gave a recommendation. Like, Randy was having some problems with his mechanics, and Nolan Ryan's like, hey, maybe you check out Tom House. And it was something as simple as like where he was landing his feet, I guess it was. I mean, what was that like working with Randy Johnson, and what did you have to kind of help him with?
Yeah, I had known Randy because, you know, obviously Randy pitched at USC, and we were actually in Seattle. I was with the Rangers at the time, and Nolan and I would always go to the ballpark early, get our work done before the team got there. And it happened to be on one of the days we had finished our workout and we're sitting in the first base dugout. Balls were sizzling by the dugout about 180 miles an hour. And we looked down the right field bullpen, and that's where Randy was actually working with his pitching coach at the time and obviously having trouble throwing strikes. So as Randy finished up and was walking by our dugout on the way over to the third base dugout where their team dugout was, I said, hey, Randy, how you doing? He said, I'm not doing well at all. I'm having trouble throwing strikes. And Nolan kind of popped up and said, Randy, I'll tell you what, we're working out again tomorrow. Why don't you come by about this time and we'll talk through some things and see if we can figure it out. So we made a small adjustment in the way Randy was landing in his delivery as he took his stride. And 3 weeks later, he punched out 18 of us in 18 checks. So it probably ended up costing me my job. I'm not sure. So they became friends. The three of us actually did a video in Alvin, Texas called Fastball. And it was Nolan and Randy that were the main part of the video. And it's a keeper. I still laugh at it today. It took Randy 30 takes to say, hi, my name is Randy Johnson. The information on this video helped me lead the American League in strikeouts last year. It took him like 30 takes to get that done. to this day, Nolan still laughs and makes fun of Randy. So, you know, you guys really did your homework. This is awesome. People don't realize what goes on behind the scenes and how much fun baseball can actually be. So thank you for asking these questions. I'm having a great time.
Oh, we are too. There's another USC legend you work with, Tom Seaver. Well, that was, you guys were in college together. What was that relationship like?
Well, it was one of awe, if you want to know. I came out of Nogales High School in Montpointe. I put up some pretty good numbers and thought I was pretty cool. And my first bullpen at USC, Tom Seaver was throwing next to me. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm going, holy crap. And Rod comes up and puts his hand on my shoulder and said, tell me, House, what do you think of young Tom Seaver? And I said, Rod, if you need me to do that, you got the wrong left-hander. And Ross said, no, I don't need you to throw like him. I need you to be the best Tommy House you can be. He's going to be after the bat. You're going to be before the bat. You're both going to win 30 games for me. So it turned out, you know, Rod, you know, he predicted it perfectly. Obviously, Seaver went on to be a Hall of Famer. But I did win a few games for Rod, and I did play in the big leagues. So it was an eye-opener.
Nice.
We talked about you. You know, you played at USC, graduated with a couple degrees from USC, playing with Tom Seaver, helping out with Randy Johnson, playing under Rod Dedeaux. What's your favorite USC memory? We're talking about all-time legends in this conversation, talking about USC, but what's your favorite one?
My favorite story has to do with Billy Lee, who was actually best man in my wedding. We're in a game. We're watching what's going on. Billy and I, so I think we were in the bullpen that day. And Billy looks at me and said, "Housie, I got this pitching thing figured out." And I said, "Okay, talk to me." He said, "You have to be before the bat or after the bat. You just can't be during the bat." And that is, that's one of the highlights of my SC career, because he's exactly right. You just don't. And I think he pitched for 14 years with that philosophy. He just was real slow or real fast and just tried to avoid whatever bat speed was the hitter was presenting. And, you know, his thinking and making it simple probably helped me in my career as well.
You played, you know, for the Rod Dedeaux years, and, you know, the, obviously legendary, that you said, the coach of the century. USC won more baseball national championships than anyone, but it's been a while, you know, 1998. You coached in the modern times. Is there, you know, the way the college baseball is set up now, can USC get back to the kind of glory days they were and try to win championships again?
I think they can. It's going to take what amounts to be a perfect storm, because obviously not all things are created equal when it comes to the cost of an education and the recruiting rules and what you can and can't do with scholarships. A lot of it is stacked against schools like USC, but it can be done. I think they're on the right track, figuring out that the current head coach and his staff are very good recruiters. And basically the legend of USC was, like you said, all those national championships. I don't think anybody is going to ever put those kind of numbers up again, because there's just too much parity involved in collegiate sports. But there's no reason at all, if they recruit well and develop like I know they can be competitive.
Well, speaking of USC, during this offseason, Keaton Slovis has been training with another organization you're part of, the 3D QB training group, with Adam Dedeaux, John Beck, and Taylor Kelly. Not sure how involved you are in Keaton's training in particular, but he's a guy that said he's never really studied with a QB or a mechanics coach previously, and he seemed to kind of lose his way, lost his confidence last year, but he seems to have it back now after training with your guys. What kind of stuff do you guys do to help a quarterback feel assured in themselves?
Well, we keep it very simple, but when you come to rotational athletes, there's four things in their health and performance puzzle. There's biomechanics, there's functional strength, there's their mental emotional approach to stress and anxiety, and then there's obviously nutrition and sleep for recovery. So when a young quarterback or any quarterback comes to 3D QB, they're going to get all four of those things. And Adam, obviously, is Rod's grandson. And I'm trying to retire. I still have regular input with those guys. They're doing the day-to-day grinded out hands-on work on the field. But I'll go up on occasion. I still help with research. Anything new, anything we can possibly do to help improve the offering that 3D QB puts out there. Those three guys do a very good job. I think at this point in time, they have like 22 of the number one starters in the NFL, a whole bunch of the backups, and probably 25 or 30 of the collegiate quarterbacks that are going to get into the NFL. So they do a really good job. And again, the young man you're talking about, you know, when you get hurt, or he came out of nowhere his freshman year and put up some really good numbers and then got dinged up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And when anybody gets hurt, it's hard to be as effective and efficient as you should be while you're compensating with an injury. And I think that dinged his confidence a little bit. But it's being put back together pretty well. My litmus test is that I'm not getting phone calls to come up and help with the mental emotional side of things. So my guess is combination of Adam, John, and Taylor working with him is going to turn out really good for the Trojan football team.
Is that kind of a common thing you would see, a diagnosis like a sophomore slump where, like you said, he comes out of nowhere his freshman year, there was an injury, there was a pandemic, there's a lot of weird stuff that happened, and it just didn't, you thought that great strides were going to be made during the sophomore year, the ball didn't look the same. Do you kind of see that often, and then sometimes you just kind of have to reset and get things back on track to maybe get back to the basics?
Perfect observation. You know, when you come in and you're not expected to do anything, it's a little easier than when expectations are put on you that are actually greater than what you did the year before. And then you combine that with, again, the pandemic and the lack of predictability and the, you know, there was really no process they could hang their hat on. I think he did well just to survive. So as the new season progresses and everything starts getting back to normal, I think the results are going to be much better than they were a year ago.
We talked about Keaton struggling, and initially it seemed like it was mental with him. Having worked with numerous players throughout your years, how tough is it to get a guy, especially a young guy, out of a little bit of a mental funk?
Well, I think Yogi Berra said it best that 90% of sports are 50% mental. And to that end, we literally try to decide and determine through some of our testing what kind of a learner is the kid we're dealing with. You know, is he auditory? Is he kinesthetic? Does he have to feel it or see it? And then we try to tailor and reframe how we teach to how he learns. And with that in mind, combine that with the program that the athlete's actually dealing in or performing in, and that combined effort makes for a better mental emotional management set of skill that the kids can take between the lines and avoid the performance anxieties. Long sentence meaning just basically we work just as hard on how they think and how they feel as we actually do with their mechanics and their strength.
Well, we're hoping for a big season out of Keaton Slovis, and it sounds like he's on a positive track. One of the organizations that you're working with now is the new Mustard app that analyzes video that people take on their own and kind of delivers them a report card. So maybe even Keaton Slovis can use this. You guys haven't got the football portion out, but that's something that's in the works as well. The Mustard app itself kind of breaks down a player's motion and gives them a report card on how they're doing with their motion. How do you hope that this new app helps users?
Guys, you hit it dead on. It's actually, we're trying to democratize or make available to the moms and dads of 100 million preteens and whatever is out there as teenage and 20-year-olds, the same exact thing that athletes get when they come to 3DQB or the National Pitching Association, but put it on a cell phone. So, like I said, a mom can capture her 12-year-old throwing in the backyard, send that video through the app to Mustard, and within 2 minutes get the same motion analysis that the elite athletes have been coming to either 3DQB or our lab down here in San Diego. And the efficacy of the information is the same. The evaluation process, the problem identification process, and the solutions are all exactly the same thing, but instead of having to pay, you know, $5,000-$10,000 if you're a pro guy or whatever it might be, you can get it through the cell phone. And that will literally, what we're trying to do is make people understand the power of play and the value proposition that sport brings to these youngsters. The research shows if we can keep, sidebar real quick, right now, 80% of the kids, male and female, that are playing sports will quit by age 14.
Wow.
If we can get them to participate in whatever their sport is through high school, then you basically have a fan for life who understands all the value proposition that competing in sports actually create for real life experiences. So it sounds a little altruistic, but the feedback we're getting is off the charts good. And we're finishing up beta testing right now and should have a full offering with the first round, which is throwing pitching mechanics, soon to be followed by throwing a football, swinging a bat, swinging a golf club. All the sports that youngsters participate in will hopefully within the next 2 years be able to be measured and quantified on a cell phone, which I think is totally cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. If you need a beta tester for the golf swing, let me know. I hack around, so I'm in.
I'll tell you what, we can tell you what you're doing wrong. I can't guarantee you'll be able to fix it.
Yeah, I've tried. It doesn't really work. Yeah, that's all right.
Well, Tom, we don't want to take up too much of your time, but one more question for you. You know, you've worked with everyone from the stars, the Tom Brady's, the Drew Brees's. We talked about multiple Hall of Famers already that you've worked with. And you also still work with young kids and trying to build them up as well. And this Mustard app could definitely lead to, you know, many more young kids being able to continue playing. What brings you joy from coaching that makes you want to work with so many different age groups?
Well, I'd like to tell you I had it figured out. I actually have more fun with a 12 and under group than I do with the superstars. But I'm continually, you know, I'm sneaking up on 74. And every morning when I wake up, I can hardly wait to start moving around because I know I'm going to get out and be able to interact with kids in sports. And the only difference between a 12-year-old and a 42-year-old, you know, Tom Brady, are the lights and the paychecks. They're all big kids playing sports and doing what they love to do. And that's kind of what fuels me as I go through what I'm going through right now.
Dr. House, I know you're trying to get to retirement. I'm sorry we took a little bit more of your time. We're going to push it out a little bit longer, but it was a really fun conversation. Thank you so much for spending the time. This was great.
I had a great time, guys. Look forward to doing this again soon.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Now bringing a special guest, Gavin Morris, my guy, Gav. And I say my guy because anytime you talk to anyone about Gavin, they'll say, oh, that's my guy. So it's Gavin, my guy, Morris is basically is his name. He's a bi-coastal guy like me. He's from Los Angeles, but he went to school at Morehouse College in Atlanta. He worked for the Atlanta Braves in community relations, USC's assistant athletic director and director of player development, works a lot with recruiting and whatnot with USC and everyone's guy at USC. So want to bring Gavin on because of his connection with the Braves. He's worked with the Braves. He also got to meet Hank Aaron, worked underneath him. So wanted to bring him on for this special episode with the USC and Hank Aaron connection. Gavin, thanks for joining us first off, man.
Oh, no, Shotgun. You know, we go way back and, you know, I always tease you because you got a Braves hat. You got a Braves hat on today?
I do not. I got a Georgetown hat on today, but, okay. You know, normally would have a Braves hat on.
Yeah, well, outside of myself, your hat collection is one of the best. As you see, I got my champion's hat, my Lakers and Dodgers champion hat on.
As a Braves and Rays fan, I definitely do not want to talk about that last MLB championship at all.
Well, hey, we beat both of them, so
I know the heartbreak is definitely there. But you got an opportunity to work for the Braves. You're in community relations. And got a chance to meet Hank Aaron and working with them. What was it like just first off getting an opportunity to meet him and kind of pick his brain a little bit?
Man, well, I guess I got to give you a story on how I actually met Hank Aaron. So just give you a story. Hank Aaron's daughter, Cicely Heidel, was my Spanish teacher. And so when I was in college, everybody said, you got to take the Spanish teacher, Miss Heidel, you know. So I was, you know, I was trying to cut corners. So I didn't register and I would just show up to the class. And she was like, well, you're not on my roll. So I don't know why you keep showing up here. I just kept showing up here. I said, I'll be on the roll by the end of the year. And so I would show up, you know, probably not every day, but most days, the class. Finally, like the last day of ads and drops, my name showed up on the official roll. And, you know, she looked at me. She was just like, how'd this happen? And so from that standpoint, me and Miss Heidel just became best friends. And she's telling me stories about Hank Aaron. And I said, she knew I always wanted to work in sports. And what happened was I ended up working for NASCAR. And then I think it was my first senior year. She was like, do you want to work for the Braves? I said, hell yeah. I'll go work for the Braves. She's like, okay, well, I'll call my dad's best friend and make it happen. So, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And so Miss Heidel, I end up meeting Hank Aaron's secretary and then Hank Aaron's one of his best friends. And I end up getting a job with Atlanta Braves. So I started with the Braves. I'm working there for 2 months. Now, anybody knows Hank Aaron, he's a figurehead at the Braves. He was spending a lot of time building up Hank Aaron BMW. So his time was going to Hank Aaron BMW. So it was one day, it's probably like a month and a half, 2 months working for the Braves. I'm coming around the corner and I run directly into Hank Aaron and he had a cup of coffee and the coffee spilled all on his white dress shirt.
Wow, Gavin.
And so my jaw just dropped. I'm like, oh, excuse my language, but oh shit, it's Hank Aaron. And he's like, my shirt. So I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. So Hank's like, ah, oh, okay. And so he just walks off into his office and Hank Aaron had his secretary who was his gatekeeper. And nobody walked past hers. I guess I'm spilling some beans, but if Hank Aaron probably didn't sign your ball, and you didn't see him sign it, she probably was the one that signed the ball. You know, if you just got something in the mail saying it was Hank Aaron, it's probably his secretary who was with him for like 20 years. And I'm like, I got to, you know, say thank you because it was a minority internship how I got the job. And it was a Hank Aaron minority internship. So I'm like, I have to say something to Hank. So I just bust into his office. His secretary is... you know, you can't go in there with that. I just bust in. And mind you, I just spilled coffee on him. He's on the phone in his office. And he's on the phone. And he looks. And he goes, whoever he's on the phone, he goes, hold on, I'm going to have to call you back. Somebody just bombarded in my office. And he hangs up. He goes, you again. I go, Mr. Aaron, you know, I apologize. I just want to introduce myself. I'm a friend of Cicely Heidel. You know, I just wanted to, you know, say thank you. She was like, you know my daughter? He was like, I don't believe you. And so he calls her. Now, mind you, this is, it's 2001. So, you know, cell phones are just coming in. So he calls Miss Heidel and he goes, I got some gentleman in my office says he knows you. And he goes, what's your name? And I go, Gavin Moore. And I could just hear her screaming in the through the phone. Oh, daddy, that's my favorite, blah, blah, blah. Da, 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 da. And so he hangs up the phone with her. He goes, all right, you checked out. And we sat there for 20, 30 minutes just talking and just about life, about everything. Of course, I knew a lot about the day, you know, he broke the record because his daughter, the family couldn't attend the game because they had bomb threats and, you know, they had threats against the family as well as Hank Aaron's life. So they had like the FBI in front of the house. So they saw it on TV. So, you know, we just sat there and talked for 20, 30 minutes. And when I tell you, it was probably the most inspirational 20, 30 minutes of my life to sit there with the legend, Hank Aaron, and just spend time and just know that I'm sitting here, I'm working for the Braves, because of him. Like, it gives me chills just saying the story, because, you know, a lot of people don't know that story. I don't tell that story often, but yeah, that's how I first met Hank Aaron. It started off bad, but it finished great. And, you know, what he meant to the city. And I later on became friends with the grandson of Bill Bartholomew, who's the one who moved the Braves from Milwaukee to Atlanta and integrated the South professional. Because people don't know, Atlanta Braves were the first professional sports teams in the South of the Dixie line. They were the first sports teams in the South. And one time, my friend Brian Duffy, his brother committed suicide, so they had a scholarship fund that they were doing for in his honor. And I got a chance to sit with Bill Bartholomew, all the heads of the Braves, his family. I was one of his guests, and I sat right next to Bill. And Bill told me the story on how they moved the Braves, Milwaukee Braves, to Atlanta. And, you know, he was just telling me, like, we couldn't do it without Hank Aaron's approval. Like, Hank Aaron was our superstar. And he was telling how he flew out, met with Joseph E. Lowery, Martin Luther King, all the Black leaders in Atlanta at that time to, you know, get their approval on the movie, because it wasn't just an easy move, like, you know, Supersonics moving to OKC. This was integrating the South, and not everybody was on board. And matter of fact, one of my boys, he's doing a documentary on the move and Hank Aaron and his grandfather, Bill Bartholomew. So that's my little background of Hank Aaron and how I met Hank. And, you know, of course, we met quite a few other times after that, but just in the city of Atlanta, how much he meant to the city. And people understand, like, Hank Aaron is the reason why you have NBA in the South, why you have the Atlanta Falcons, you have the Miami Dolphins, you have the Carolina Panthers, Atlanta Hawks. There were no professional teams in the South. And because Hank Aaron, because, you know, he was about to break the record, and he gave permission to say, look, I'm willing to move to Atlanta from Milwaukee. That changed sports forever. And a lot of people don't look at it like that, because they think Hank Aaron is just breaking the home run record, but they don't understand that he broke the color barrier and just sports barrier for the South.
Yeah, and definitely, I mean, Milwaukee was having some issues as well with race as well. Right. And that was one of the things that they had to sell him on, what was going. He's like, if we're already having these issues in Milwaukee, how bad is it going to be in Atlanta? And so he had to go down there and meet with them. And, you know, when he gave his approval, that was basically the final notch in them being able to move to Atlanta, which I'm thankful for as a Braves fan, you know, to have him there. And
that's,
you know,
my second team.
Okay, but you don't root for him at all when the Dodgers are on, unfortunately. but obviously, Hank Aaron, he transcended the game, and he was such a kind of a shy person and didn't look out for the accolades. He wasn't a gregarious person necessarily. And Tom House, who we talked to earlier in the podcast, talked a little bit about being his teammate and how he was a great teammate, but not the guy that, you know, is going to be out front of anything like that. What did you take away from the conversations you had with him, just that maybe you've been able to use in your career going on from the Braves to now being at USC, and just kind of the relationships that you build as, you know, as someone in the recruiting department for USC?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, he was a fighter. You know, what he told me was, like, at that time, like, you got to understand, at that time when he did it, he never thought it was going to be this big. You know, like it's easier for us to look back and go, wow, you, like, Hank Aaron, you did that. But at, you know, he's saying at that moment, like, he was just trying to protect his family and provide for his family and make sure that his family was safe. And, you know, the things, stuff that I deal with doesn't even compare to what he had to go through. Like I said, the family couldn't even go to the game because of safety reasons. And so you know, when I have a bad day at work, my bad day was a little bit different than Hank Aaron's bad day. And, you know, the relationships and the people that, you know, I'm a relationship guy, but just a, you know, living in Atlanta, just like everybody adores Hank Aaron, you know. And you know, working for the Braves, you remember the old Fulton County Stadium? They still had the 755, you know, the wall in the parking lot, and so it always reminded you of what he did and what he had to fight through. And to me, what I always took away was just never give up, keep fighting, and just never take no for answer. He could have easily given up from the death threats, from everything, but he kept fighting and he kept pursuing and he kept showing up to the park every day and giving his all. And he broke that record. And I can't even imagine, you know, what was going through his head, you know, when he hit that home run. And then to see the guy run on the field, you don't know if that guy's trying to kill you or shake your hand, you know, to the South, to the city of Atlanta. He was everything, you know, being from Alabama. And just, I remember he was telling me a story just how, you know, moving up the minor leagues and coming, you know, we thought Major League Baseball was bad. He said what he had to deal with coming up in baseball in his early years was 10 times worse. So, you know, I never had to experience that. You know, I lived in the South, and it wasn't the South that he lived in. And a lot of he was, like I said, he walked hand in hand with Martin Luther King, Joseph E. Lowry, all those Black leaders. And I'm on the spot, so I'm forgetting some of them. But he walked hand in hand with them to change, to make changes, not just in sports, but just so that a person like myself could sit at a counter or stay in the same hotel. You remember, one of the biggest things when he moved was what neighborhood would you live in? He wasn't able to live in the same neighborhoods as his white teammates. So a lot of those things, you know, he broke that kid. He was on the forefront of changing how we look at sports. And there was others, but like I said, he did it when Blacks couldn't sit at the same countertop and in the South.
What do you take away from the way he has always carried himself? He carried himself throughout his career, but also after his career, when he, you know, becomes a part of the Braves organization and throughout until his unfortunate passing earlier this year, because you guys are very different as far as you're very gregarious and he was more of a quiet guy. But the way he carries himself, what do you take away from that and the interactions you had with him that you can use yourself as well?
Yeah, I mean, to give back, you know, people understand I got that position because of the minority internship that he provided. But it wasn't something that he, you know, put on social media or broadcast, because he did things for people at the goodness of his heart, not because he wanted attention. And that's one thing that I took. Sometimes you have to do it for the right reasons, not to get the accolades and the credit. You know, it's so many things he did for the Black community in Atlanta that people just don't know. I thank him for where I'm at today. You know, I think me getting a taste of working in professional sports, actually working for an actual team, dealing with players, dealing with, you know, working for a friend, like I worked for NASCAR, I worked in the corporate office, which is different than when you actually work for an actual team, it's different. Mm-hmm. and that's the thing. He didn't do it for the credit. He did it because he cared about people and he cared about helping others get opportunity and open doors for other people. And like I said, he opened doors for me that I will be forever grateful for. You know, that's what I try to do at USC. I try to help people. You know, they tease me about this thing called the Gavin Tree, but I try to help people get jobs. I try to help what's the point of having a relationship if you don't use it? So for my interns, you know, when they graduate, I try to help them. If I can make a phone call to somebody, if I can write a recommendation, even some of my coworkers, if I know somebody at another team, I'll make that call to help them, because somebody helped me. And Hank Aaron was the one to help me. And that was the biggest thing. It was, don't just do things for yourself. Do things to help others. And that's something that he always tried to do. And he didn't do it for the credit or for attention. He did it at the goodness of his heart.
Where does he stand in the pantheon of all-time sports greats for you? I mean, having a personal relationship, I feel like that.
Oh, he's the GOAT. He's the GOAT. He's the GOAT. I mean, it's not even – there's no question. Like I said, talking to Bill Bartholomew, who, you know, owned the Braves, and when he's sitting there telling me this story about – like, I guess people just don't understand. There were no sports in the South at that time. There was none, you know, just as, you know, when USC went down to Alabama and they changed the, you know, when they beat Bear Bryant and they integrated the SEC, he integrated professional sports. I don't think, you know, others, you know, of course I'm a Jordan fan. You know, I think he's the greatest basketball player. You know, LeBron's getting close. You know, as much as Magic and Bird changed the TV and Jordan changed TV, can you imagine him doing this and he had social media and TV? I mean, he would be the biggest superstar there ever was. He broke a record that it just wasn't a Major League Baseball record. It symbolized racism because Blacks, we weren't able to play the sport. We had to play in the Negro League. That record, Bob Gibson hit more home runs than Hank Aaron. Not Bob Gibson. Josh Gibson. Bob Gibson, great pitcher. But he never got recognized. He never got a chance to play in professional sports because of the color of his skin. So you had a man that put his career on the line, that put – he could have stayed in Milwaukee. He could live anywhere. And he chose to put – it on his back and then chase a record that, you know, could put your family in danger, could put yourself in danger. I don't think there's no record LeBron breaking the scoring title. He's not going to have a bomb threat. You know, Drew Brees breaking the passing yards or touchdown. He's not having a bomb threat. He had bomb threat. The FBI was in front of his house because of a record. And, you know, You can't. There's nothing you can put your life on a line for sports. That record, which he broke, 755, it means something. In the Black community, it means something because that, in the past, before Barry Bonds, you know, and that was like for the Black community, that was like Obama, you know, becoming president. Like, you know, he beat Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was the great white hope. You know, like I said, I don't think you could put words. I don't think you can put a dollar value on what he did. I don't think you can. There's not. I just hope younger kids, younger generation understand what he did to change sports. And I don't just mean baseball. I mean all sports.
Well, hopefully we'll have some of those kids listening to the podcast and we'll be able to hear your words and be able to feel that and touch it a little bit as well. Gavin, thanks so much for taking the time and enlighten us with your personal experiences with Hank Aaron and also what kind of the record means to you and to the community as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Chaka. Fight on.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
To close out the show, I've got another special guest, a late addition to the podcast lineup, but one I'm really excited about. I'd like to welcome in USC Annenberg professor Sandy Tolan, who was one of my professors in grad school at USC. Sandy, thanks for jumping on with us last minute.
Hey, Shotgun, it's good to talk to you again. It's been a long time. Yeah, definitely. Well, Sandy is actually a Milwaukee native, grew up a Hank Aaron fan, and has written a book titled Me and Hank, A Boy and His Hero 25 Years Later. Sandy, just tell us first off just about the book and the idea behind it.
Yeah, well, Shaka, first of all, good to be here. I was 9 years old when the Milwaukee Braves moved to Atlanta in 1965. And, you know, he was my hero even when I was a little kid, 7, 8, 9 years old. Then the Braves left and a lot of our fellow Braves fans moved on to the Cubs, or they were mad at the Braves for leaving. But I kind of just always was still into Hank, and I managed to get the Braves games on WSB in Atlanta and WSM in Nashville. And I followed it. And, you know, I would listen whenever I could tune in the games in the summertime as a kid. And then I started hearing that he was, you know, he was approaching the great record, the mythical record of 715 held by Babe Ruth. Of course, 714 homers held by Babe Ruth. But then I heard that he was getting this hate mail and death threats because he was a Black man approaching what was then considered the greatest record in sports. Interestingly, it no longer is by many people. Because he was a Black man going for this white icon, the mythical Babe Ruth and his record, he started getting so many letters. And some of them were very violent and vicious, lots of death threats. He got 900,000 letters. But before, you know, computers and, you know, laptops and so on. I mean, I figured that out at an ounce per letter, that was 29 tons of mail. And many of those tons were hate mail and saying, you know, you don't deserve it, calling him all kinds of names and threatening to kill him in some cases. And it was so, you know, I was 17 at the time that I learned this, 16 or 17, and I was so outraged. And I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. And we're still in the late era of the civil rights movement. There were a lot of racist, there are today, but it was in a way more pronounced in some ways back in the 60s and 70s. So I wrote Hank a letter. I said, "Dear Mr. Aaron, you know, you don't know me, but you've been my hero and we're rooting for you here in Milwaukee. And don't listen to these racists. We know you can do it." And, you know, I figured I'd get a letter back from the Braves or a postcard saying, "Thank you for your interest." But instead, I get a letter from Henry Aaron, dated June 20th, 1973, in which he says, "You know, dear Sandy, I want you to know how much your letter means to me." And he went on to say, "You know, if you could excuse my sentimentality, your letter means much more than I can adequately express in words." And I'm sitting there as a 17-year-old going, "You're kidding me. My hero just wrote me a letter in the middle of the chase." When at the time I didn't know, you know, his daughter was being protected by the FBI because of kidnapping threats. He had to sleep in other hotels away from his teammates. They had to bring him food into his room because they feared poisoning or assassination. I mean, and here he is at the brink of the greatest record in the history of sports, at least the way we defined it back then. He was completely alone. He didn't have his family. He didn't have his teammates, except for when he came to the clubhouse and stepped into the batter's box. So it was a really lonely journey, as I found out later. And it was only at that point, you know, when he was approaching the record and he broke the record, and then the 25-year anniversary was coming, and I thought, why don't I actually find out what he went through? You know, some of the stuff I just told you, Shotgun, is what I learned when I was researching the book. But I wrote him a letter, and he said, "Yeah." And his secretary called and said, "Yeah, come down and see you. Mr. Aaron can see you." I think it was in 1999. And I went and I did a piece for NPR, a long piece for NPR at the time. And then that turned into the book. So the book was really about not just about Hank Aaron, the great sports and baseball hero, but Hank Aaron, the civil rights hero, who didn't have any plans to be a civil rights hero, but he became a hero every time he risked his life by stepping into the batter's box.
You write the book, you get an opportunity to meet Hank Aaron. What was that experience like 25 years later from your childhood hero, getting a chance to sit down and have a chat with him?
Well, I tell you what, man, I guess I was 43 years old at the time. And I was like, I was nine again. I mean, it was crazy. I was a professional journalist. I'd been a journalist for, 18 years or whatever since, by then. And I'd interviewed senators and, world leaders and, a lot and travel all over. And here I was like a kid again. I had my microphone. I was sweating all over my microphone. And I was Mr. Aaron, and he's just kind of smiling. I'm sure this happened to all the time. And I brought my scrapbook because I had started a scrapbook, the Chase, Henry Aaron and the Chase for 715. And so in the scrapbook had these old, yellowed clippings, and they were kind of flaking all over his desk. And he was kind of looking at me like, who is this guy? But I finally, and I was all in a, coat and tie and everything. And I finally, sort of got my composure, became 43 again, and started interviewing about what he went through. And it was incredible. I mean, he told me I couldn't enjoy it. I said, well, what was your reaction when you finally broke that record? He goes, I was just glad it was over. And think about that. I mean, he couldn't enjoy it. He couldn't celebrate when he actually hit that homer on April 8th, 1974. The scoreboard in Atlanta, I think it was Fulton County Stadium back then, was exploding scoreboard and fireworks and everything. His mother was at the game and she thought he was being shot. I mean, and so part of what my book is about is the chasm of awareness, especially at that time, but even later between Black and white Americans about what someone went through, what in this case Henry Aaron went through, and the racism he had to deal with that a lot of white people didn't even think about, whereas almost every Black person in America, at least everyone that I interviewed, was extremely worried for Henry Aaron that he would be shot. And I went to some Black barbershops in Atlanta and they were like, oh my God, I thought he was gonna be shot going around the bases. So, that was really quite a journey for me. And I interviewed his daughter, I interviewed Dusty Baker, Ralph Garr was another teammate, young guys that Hank took under their wing and who told me, they just couldn't believe what they witnessed. But then I interviewed people like Phil Niekro, great guy, interviewed him. He died recently, mm-hmm. as you probably know. He had no idea. I mean, later he learned, but during that time, he had no idea what Hank Aaron was going through.
Yeah, it's interesting kind of the difference. You talked with Tom House earlier, you interviewed him for the book as well. And he was actually good friends with Dusty Baker and Gar coming up through the minors. So he said that he kind of had a little bit more awareness than some of his other teammates and felt like that was because of that relationship that with those guys that he kind of was in. But Hank kind of kept everyone out a little bit as well and kept everyone kind of protected from hearing everything about it. And that was kind of just his character, is that he was such a strong figure himself and absorbed everything and didn't let it come out in any negative light on anyone else around him, it seemed like.
Yeah. At the same time, imagine what it would be like to carry all that by yourself. That fear, he had to have some fear. I mean, there was one letter that said, I'm not sure if I'm going to shoot you with a long range rifle from the bleachers or just a handgun from the box seats. The FBI and the Braves would, have the FBI screen these letters, and they didn't let Hank see many of them, but every now and then they show him one and say, hey, do you want to play tonight or do you want to just sit out? And he would always play. And when I interviewed Dusty about this, back when he was the manager of the Giants in the San Francisco area, I went and talked to him. And he said there was one night where there was a particular threat. Some guy in a red coat was threatening to shoot at Hank. And so Hank went to Dusty and Ralph because they always sat next to him. These young Black men, sitting, absorbing all the wisdom from the elder, basically, And they said, he said, look, you guys, Ralph, Dusty, if you don't want to sit next to me tonight, there's supposed to be a guy taking a shot at me. You don't have to. And Dusty says, oh, no. Well, we said, no, Hank, we're down with you, man. If you go, we go. And he said all night, Ralph and I were looking around for a guy with a red coat. If there would have been a firework gone out, we would have jumped in. Hank wasn't even paying attention. So he had this ability that I think Tom House told me, he had this ability to compartmentalize and just, mm-hmm. that's what I guess great athletes do anyway. But imagine this in the extreme. he was compartmentalizing death threats when he stepped, you know, out of his consciousness when he stepped into the batter's box. And I think that year in 1973, I'd have to look it up, I think that was the year he hit the most home runs. 1973 was the only year he hit more than 44. He hit 47. It was either 72 or 73. It was the time that he was undergoing the greatest pressure and the greatest level of hate and anger. And somehow he was able to transform that into, you know, at age 38, 39, into one of the greatest performances of his career.
It is purely amazing, you know, the things that he went through and to still be able to go through it and do it with such a stoic demeanor, I think, and to become, you know, becoming an icon in Atlanta, you know, when he was one of the guys that said, I've lived in the South and I don't want to do it again before, you know, leaving Milwaukee, and Atlanta kind of convinced him. So as an Atlanta native, I'm very happy that they were able to convince him and that he was able to break the record as a Brave in Atlanta. But a truly inspirational character, you know, he's, you know, meant so much to so many in the Deep South and in Atlanta, and as well to you as a Milwaukee native too. So thanks, Sandy, so much for jumping on. Your last impression, you know, what do you think Hank Aaron, just overall, his body of work means to so many people?
I think Hank Aaron is going to be remembered as an incredibly courageous figure who happened to play a sport, but who set an example of perseverance and courage in the midst of an epidemic of hate. And he transcended that. He was deeply bruised and deeply scarred by his own words, but he achieved a greatness that I don't think anyone in baseball ever has, partly because of all that extra weight he carried around.
Well, Sandy, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate you jumping on late notice, short notice here, and really appreciate all of our guests that jumped on today. Just so many different perspectives and unique perspectives. Have really enjoyed these conversations. I hope you guys did as well. Thank you for everyone that's listened. That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Heard It on the Sidelines podcast, part of the Peristyle podcast family. I'm your host, Shotgun Spratling, saying thank you again to our special guests, Tom House, Gavin Morris, and Sandy Tolan, for joining us. And thanks to the boss man, Ryan Abraham, for jumping on to help out. Thanks to all of you for listening. And we hope you'll be back to join us for the next episode of the Heard It on the Sidelines podcast.
And go Braves.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.